everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. We're doing another true crime episode of the podcast, which means I'm here with my dude, Aris Pina. Aris, what's up, man?
What's going on, my friend?
Not a whole lot. I mean, we got some icky stuff to talk about today. Not as detailed as some of the true crime episodes can be, but still pretty icky.
Yeah, dude, the show we're going to do today, man, is a pretty wild story, even though, like you just said, there's not a ton of info out there on it. But it also brings us back to one of my favorite eras in boxing, you know, late 70s, early 80s heavyweights and that whole era. So everybody knows the same names that we always discuss, where, you know, that people bring up, person who would have been celebrating his 80th birthday today, Muhammad Ali, and all of his old friends, Frazier, Norton, Jimmy Young, you know, Ernie Shavers, Ron Lyle, so on and so forth, right? But the division was so deep, you know, there was always like a group of contenders that didn't quite reach that level, but still made for a lot of memorable fights and still had good careers in their own right. Guys like Scott Ledoux, guys like Mario Monroe, Len Ballin, the guy we're going to talk about today, who didn't even reach quite their level, so to speak, but still it made, you know, for some memorable fights during his career. And which is why we're talking about him today, because he had a memorable life. And that was Bill Sharkey.
That's right, man. Bill Sharkey. And actually, you know, the last name Sharkey.
New York City, Bill Sharkey.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's my place right now, you know.
The last name Sharkey, it's a couple of famous Sharkeys, far more famous Sharkeys throughout history. And of course, you hear the last name Sharkey in boxing, you're probably first going to be thinking of Jack Sharkey, who was briefly heavyweight champion in the 1930s and, you know, lost to Jack Dempsey, etc. Famously lost to Jack Dempsey with the, what do you want me to do, write him a letter, hook, you know, talking to the referee. And then there was Sailor Tom Sharkey years before then, who was a heavyweight title challenger toward James Jefferies and had fought, you know, a number of really great fighters around that time and is pretty memorable looking. But there was another Sharkey who was around many decades later. And so that's who we're talking about today. We're talking about Bill Sharkey. And that's going to be a name unfamiliar probably to most boxing fans and even to some history people, because like I mentioned before and like you reiterated, there's not nearly as much information about Bill Sharkey, what happened to him, and even stuff during his career as there would be about some of these other fighters that we've talked about in the past on these true crime episodes. But still, that era that he operated in, like you said, it was so deep, it was so good in the late 60s, early 70s, that even guys on this level, the kind of Bill Sharkey level, I mean, you could almost see him. I'm not saying they're gonna like beat a Tyson Fury or something, but you could see him hanging in there with some of the perhaps mid echelon heavyweights of today.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, given his size, he was a rather small guy compared to even.
Yeah, he wasn't real big.
He wasn't. He'd probably be a cruiserweight today. I'm not even sure if he'd be a bridgerweight, so to speak. So, but yeah, he was a good fighter. He was a tough guy. And one of those eras where even if you were a decent fighter, you were only going to reach a certain level. And whenever you stepped up, it was pretty apparent what was going to happen to you. But that being said, he still wasn't like, you know, he's still competitive. Like he fought a lot of guys, recognizable names during that time. Guys like Mike Weaver, Cali Canuzza, Frank Bruno, Scott Ledoux. So he was around, you know, and he had a, you know, an interesting personality, which we're about to talk about in a minute, coming from his background and growing up in Queens, New York. Kind of a, you know, a shady past, so to speak, but also made for an interesting character. And, you know, the brief interview clips that you can find online, you can tell right away by his style, the way he talks and stuff like that, he has a sort of, you know, a sort of chip on his shoulder, so to speak. But yeah, he was one of those fighters that, you know, added into the late 70s and early 80s of the heavyweight division, cruiserweight heavyweight division, and he mixed in with all of them. I mean, not so much with a lot of success, but enough that, you know, people from that era definitely remember him.
Yeah, he was obviously a memorable dude in terms of personality, and he fought hard too. He might not have been a very big guy, but he was fairly intimidating looking. I don't know. I mean, I guess looking back, it's not intimidating. It's not intimidating looking back and seeing a guy who kind of looks like could have been like your uncle drinking beer at like a you know, some kid's birthday party or something like that with the handle. He has like a handlebar mustache. He's got like curly hair that's kind of like mid-length. Doesn't really look, he's well built, but doesn't look super impressive. So, I mean, you know, he's retrospect.
Not a big guy, but like, you know, with the hair that he has, mentioned the handlebar mustache and all that. And then you find out, reading part of his background, he used to be a hairdresser at one point.
Yeah.
He doesn't look like the type of guy that, you know, would you'd be intimidated by or do anything like that. But no, he was tough as nails. And going by his background, former gang member and former gang leader, actually.
Yeah, I was saying before the show that you knew a little bit more about his background than I do, but there's a little bit out there in terms of like reading about his career and stuff like that in newspapers. And there's, in particular, like on YouTube, there's one video of him fighting Kali Kanutsa, the South African, which we'll get to that in a little bit. But yeah, there's this element, and I think that this kind of ties into what we've talked about in a lot of these true crime episodes. Not always, but often it's guys who come from just rough areas or rough backgrounds. And by the time that Bill Sharkey even found his way to boxing in the early 1970s, he had already been through a lot. He'd run the streets in New York. He found himself in prison already, you know, and that's kind of like where he'd even gotten by his mid-20s into boxing. He'd already lived a lifetime.
Absolutely, man. So like you just alluded to, he was already in trouble. You know, he was a leader of a gang in New York, based out of Howard Beach in Queens, which was a very rough area to begin with from back then. And he was, you know, running the streets, kind of running wild. And at the age of 19, apparently he came home one day to see a bunch of cop cars and ambulances and all kinds of other nonsense going on around there, to find out that his parents were the victim of a murder-suicide. His dad killed his mom and then killed himself after that. And so for anybody, you know, I can't even imagine what that must be like to go through that type of thing already. Like, you come home and that's where you walk into just unknowingly or anything like that. Like, the effect that must take on you and what that must fuck you up with afterwards is, like, mind-blowing. So we'll just say that Sharkey definitely had a lot of demons in his closet and a lot of stuff going on, when it would be an understatement. But he was able to channel a lot of that, I guess, in the boxing, because for a good while, even though he did get in some more trouble after this, which I'm going to let you get into, he, for the most part afterwards, when he was able to clean himself up a little bit, he did channel everything, you know, all of his anger, all the issues that he was going through in life, and try to, as other people that went through stuff like Johnny Tapia and other guys from the past, like, at least trying to use an outlet in boxing for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it sounded like he was already kind of pointed in the wrong direction by the time that had happened with his parents.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
But even if he weren't, that's enough to make somebody snap. I mean, and I know that's kind of like a phrase that, I mean, I understand that mental illness is more delicate than that, and the things that people go through are far more complex than just snapping. But nonetheless, you know, arriving home to find both your parents dead and under those circumstances is enough to make a bad situation worse. And that sounds like it's exactly what happened. I don't know all of the details, but I know that Sharkey wound up killing a guy at his apartment, at the other person's apartment, that wound up being some sort of case of mistaken identity or mix-up. But in any case, Bill Sharkey goes to prison for 3 years for a manslaughter conviction. And when he gets out at 24, 25, that's when he starts boxing. That's when he gets into boxing, turns pro, and starts having some surprising success, actually. Not really against good opposition, but surprising success anyway.
Well, you think about it again. This is now the mid-70s, and with mid-70s boxing, a lot of guys, even guys that went on to, you know, become really good professionals, world champions and stuff like that, if you look at their early records, they are very active, but a lot of those guys, they fought often, they fought against experienced guys, but they weren't against the people with the best-looking records either. You know what I mean? They fought guys that, it's just, you know, there were a lot of opponents back then. Boxing was much more unregulated. It's been mentioned in many articles and other stuff that how boxing was much more of the wild, wild west back then in terms of activity and really wanting to pad a record and such and so on. It was easy to do. So Sharky,
that was like one of the last times too when somebody could get away with like a pseudonym, you know, like a funny nickname and actually go by that name in boxing, you know.
And then like change your name up, fight this way, do that, do, you know, that was going on up until '90s, probably up in the early 2000s. And but much more prevalent in the 70s when you were able to get away with that type of deal or just pad your record up all over the country, you know what I mean? So Sharky was developing a little bit of a following up in Queens and the upstate New York area, you know, Long Island area. And like you mentioned, he had a record, he filled it up until around, he was about 15, 16 and 0. And then at that point, he was going to fight a guy by the name of Mike Weaver, who at the time would go on to become a world champion. But at that moment, he was still an 11-6 fighter. And that was Sharky's first taste of defeat.
Yeah, you know, he was 15-0 going into that fight. And it sounded like that was, you know, not as if like he wasn't trying to win, but that it was a surprise that he had gotten that far undefeated. And so, you know, you talked about going into that fight, they had mentioned the other, like he was a mason, he was a hairdresser. He had gone through this kind of like small list of professions. And I mean, I that was probably as much due to the fact that he had gotten into some legal trouble. And I mean, was having issues holding a job, perhaps. I don't really know the details on that, but that was part of kind of his story leading up to that Weaver fight.
To say that he was a hothead would probably be an understatement too, because by all accounts of going what, by his own records and what he said in interviews and such and what, you know, you read about and what you can see in the limited footage there is, you can kind of tell he has a chip on his shoulder and a little bit of a temper. So yeah, just trying to hold a normal 9-to-5 wouldn't be something that would normally suit Bill Sharkey out, I think.
Yeah, he didn't really seem like somebody who was who would have an easy time adjusting, basically. And on top of that, kind of speaking to his, like I was talking about his size earlier, and that he doesn't in retrospect seem very intimidating, but at the time he probably would have been, because I mean, also, man, you gotta remember like workout videos and shit like that, like fools who were supposed to be intimidating or guys who are supposed to be manly and what they were wearing at this point. I mean, from the mid 70s to the early 80s, like bare midriffs and cutoffs and shit like that, see-through shirts, like manly guys were wearing shit like this. So a guy with like with the long curly hair and the mustache, you know what I mean? Like that was probably intimidating then.
I mean, absolutely. I'll go everyone talks about Apollo Creed. That's probably the best way to look at it, huh?
Saying, you know, yeah, I know, like they're running to embrace each other at the beach, like in slow motion.
Or people were like, that, oh, wow. When he was just smoking Rocky's boots on the beach when he was running by him. Every single time, he was always wearing the midriff cut off at every single thing in the short shorts.
They loved that shit, dude. And people were watching this being like, oh, I need to be like this with my bros. And pretty why not? Be like that with your bros.
I'm just saying. Michael Olajide, all those fighters. That was like the in thing back in the day.
Yep. The extreme Jerry curl with like the, yep. Just saying. But no, you know, he was, he obviously had an intimidating personality though. Like he, I think just the way, and it's not like we know a lot of it, but go find the Cali Canuza fight. And Aris and I were just talking about this before we were recording, because it's funny, but it's also, I think, gives away some hints of his personality and hints of, like, you know, him as a person. They're very small things to seize on, but still, I think, you know, they're telling. They're interviewing both Bill Sharkey and Cali Canuza before the fight. And he's so dismissive of a lot of the things that are said, because it's almost like they're asking the normal questions, like, how do you feel? Are you scared? Are you nervous? This type of shit. And he's just sitting there like, yeah. Like unaffected. He just doesn't really give a shit. Like he's gone through a lot in his life. And at this point, whatever it is that you have, you know, you might win, he might lose, whatever, but you're not going to like phase him. And I think that's the shit there. You know, he's gone through a lot.
And so, yeah, so what you're alluding to is that, like, before this fight, so he fights Mike Weaver, and I'm not sure if he was probably being, if he was an underdog or not. Weaver would might have been an underdog or not, because Weaver went into his town, to the Beacon Theater in New York, to fight him. But regardless, Weaver
had so many ups and downs in his career too. At that so, point, I mean, who knows?
Weaver probably was, you know, much tougher at that point than Bill Sharkey was. But Weaver ends up winning a majority decision, by all accounts, a really bruising good affair. It's not anywhere online, so I couldn't tell you. I've never seen it. But anyways, after a few more wins, he ends up fighting Cali Conesa. So the controversy before the fight was, since the fight was taking place in Miami Beach, they were trying to basically block Conesa from fighting out there over what was going on in South Africa with apartheid.
This subject's been coming up on boxing social media. Something that's been mentioned
a little bit. So on boxing Twitter over the past few days, with a lot of, you know, recent news developing and all that. So So Cali Conesa in the late 70s was probably at the height of it when it came to the controversy of boxing and apartheid and what was going on, because unlike another fighter who went on to become champion, Harry Kotsia, who was also active during that time, Conesa was a very low-key personality. Conesa was a very bold, brash, obnoxious type guy who also came with a lot of baggage and controversy because he was a cop, pro-apartheid, and shot a black youth during a controversial situation that arose. And so, yeah, there was a lot of issues going on with him, and a lot of people were very angry that he was able to be a fighter and try to come to America and ply his trade and make money off of that. Understandably so. So with all that being said, there's much, much more to dive into, but we did a podcast on that. Anyway, long story short, that was a lot of controversy arising from Conesa fighting over here and all that. So they asked Sharkey beforehand, you know, were you like kind of frazzled and anything, like you just mentioned, were you bothered by any of that? And Sharkey just kind of was like, oh, yeah, like you said, just very uncaring, slightly. Well, I think Cali's going to be much more messed up than I would be. And just kind of sits there just, you know, looking, matter of fact, looking away like almost like disinterested. And then Conesa tries to mess with him in a really thick accent, which I'm not even going to try to impersonate because I would butcher it. But he basically just kind of says something to the effect of, oh, yeah, you know, like, you look a little nervous over there anyways. Yeah, well, he like rubs them. He like touches Sharky's arm. He's like, yeah, loosen up. It's okay, buddy. Like, you know, don't be so scared. And you see Sharky, he has his arms slugged.
He's just going like this. He's going.
Yeah, yeah. He's just shaking his head saying like, bro, do you know I'll just like snuff you right now if necessary? Like, yes. Like, he's almost saying like, you're lucky the cameras aren't here because we'd be thrown down. That's how he's doing it.
Yeah, exactly. It was that kind of look, like he's just like, man, you're lucky this is gloves. You're lucky this is in some theater and not on the street, motherfucker.
Like, there's no way anyone would ever disrespect me like this. Like, you just stand, I'm standing right there and you going over shaking my arm, talking to me like I'm a little child. Which he essentially was doing. He was talking down to him like he was a kid.
To be fair, Cali Conesa did treat him like a little child in the ring.
Yeah, yeah, during the fight.
Kind of beat him. He beat him up pretty good. But I mean, you know, look, I think that a lot of that also was, first of all, like to respond to something you were saying, I think that's a really good point. Cali Conesa was like the epitome of what was bad about, well, I mean, obviously this might not have necessarily been an ethical issue for a lot of people who were against apartheid or who spoke out against it. It was also a social issue because it was during the time activism in this kind of issue, in this specifically in this issue with Sun City, with South Africa, both Bofuta Tswana and boxing and Sun City and apartheid, and taking a stance was something that was important in among celebrities too. I'm not trying to downplay the ethical involvement of it, but you know, it became something of a, as they say, cause célèbre, like a you know, cause du jour, something that people are going to speak out against because it's popular to speak out against. And if you don't speak out against it one way or another, then, you know, you're the worst kind of asshole type of thing. And for those kinds of issues, for that climate, Cali Conesa like represented a very polarizing, you know, he was a very polarizing figure when it came to apartheid and taking a stance on apartheid. And so, yeah, he had been spoken out against, and the people willing to promote him, bring him to the U.S., promote the shows when he did fight in the U.S., you know, those people were taken to task you know, during that time. And so anyway, yeah, I don't know that necessarily Bill Sharkey had any sort of involvement or whether he voiced much of an opinion specifically on that. I have no idea. But regardless,
I'm going to assume no.
Probably just, not.
Like, you know, you're telling me to wear a shirt, I'm going to fight who I'm going to fight, and I'm just going to show up.
Right. Yeah, he was probably just like, whatever, dude, fine, put him up there, I'll fight him. But regardless, yeah, that's so it was kind of unfortunate. I guess Bill Sharkey in that regard had a chance to kick Kylie Knutz's ass on U.S. soil and didn't quite get to it.
You know, there was a few guys back then. Knutz was just a big bully, you know, not to move too far off the subject really quick, but that's what he was. If you watch, because there's a lot of footage of Knutz out there. If you see his like fights before he finally got humbled by John Tate, he just kind of walks in. I mean, he's not an outright just wild slugger, but he's a crude dude. But he's clearly powerful and he just kind of beats you down. And he was just bullying these guys and
overwhelm you, kind of club you.
Yeah, he was just kind of clubbing and overwhelming these dudes. Like he beat up Bobic, who was completely shot at that point. And that's him. A guy by the name of Denton Ruddock, who was a journeyman from the UK at that point. I'm not sure if that fight's still on YouTube, but same thing. Ruddock does his best to keep him off him, but he's too small to keep Knutz off him. And same thing with Bill Sharkey. Sharkey tries his damnedest for the four rounds that it goes. It's not like he didn't try, man. He's a very game fighter, but Knutz was just way too big and way too strong and just grounded him and beat him down.
Also worth mentioning that they were frequently looking for black opponents for Knutz. Specifically because that's what sold, you know, like that's like it sounds dumb because it's like in the 1970s and you're like, ah, that doesn't seem like it's that long ago. Like, what the fuck, bro? Hello. You know, like that's still how this shit was going all the way up until Holmes, Cooney and beyond. You know what I mean? Like trying to specifically find black opponents for this guy because he was controversial. But regardless, needless to say, Bill Sharkey was not a black dude. He was a very kind of, you know, every man looking white guy when it comes to his look. But even so, Cali just tooled him, dude. He was too much for him. And I think that it spoke to one, Sharkey's a little undersized for the guys who was starting to get bigger in the division. You know, Bill Tate was not massive, but he was one of the kind of like a precursor to a lot of the bigger heavyweights because he was a pretty big dude. But Bill Sharkey was not a big dude. And you could see it against Knutz. He didn't have the power. He didn't have the physical strength to keep him off. And he just got eaten up. You know, he got totally overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And also spoke to like, that was, you ain't going to get past that level. Like you already lost to Mike Weaver and then you're getting blown out by Cali Knutz. Like, I think that you've seen.
Yeah, you've reached a certain ceiling there. Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure if you would call that even fringe contendership. Like if,
yeah,
like he fought a draw with Scott Ledoux right before he fought Knutz, and again that kind of shows you where your ceiling is at right there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing. Like I mentioned, the guys that I mentioned early in the show, like Lynn Ball and Marty Monroe and all, you know, others of that ilk, they were good fighters. All right, they made for really good fights that were featured on television back in the day, and you can find them on YouTube today. They're like really good fighters, but they just weren't. You know, that division was so deep back then that even in the late 70s when a lot of the, you know, a lot of the really, really great fighters of that era, like slowing down or some outright retiring, that division was still deep as shit. And yeah, man, like there was levels to that, bro, you know? So clearly there was a level right there for where Sharkey was headed.
Well, and it seemed as though if you just look at on BoxRec, if you look at kind of like the flow of his career, it makes sense because it seems as though there's some thought being put into this, right? Like, he has a little win streak before losing to Greg Sorrentino, not a good fighter really by any means, but he loses on points in 8 rounds. And it's like, you know, when you're getting below 10 rounds, if you're the kind of fighter who needs a few rounds to get going, especially during this era when like a loss or two ain't going to kill you, fine. You know, like that's, you're all right. Gets a draw with Scott Ledoux. Scott Ledoux is a name at that point, not a great fighter, but a name. And it's like, all right, fine. You know, you're working yourself into a fight with Cali Knutz, which you get blown out in. It's Cali Knutz. You're outsized. You know, I'm just saying, kind of playing devil's advocate in terms of how his career is being guided. Marvin Kemmel. All right. Well, this guy's a future cruiserweight champion. And it's like, well, okay, losing to him's not like a shame or anything, but then you wind up getting tooled by Frank Williams, who's 9-4-1, and he takes like a 3-year break after that. So I kind of, it's almost like you're like, oh shit, dude, well, if I'm getting decision by Frank Williams, maybe I need to rethink this shit, you know? And that's kind of what it looks like. And then he goes and comes back in 1982, has a bit of a win streak. And but then what's that?
Here's a footnote though. A quick footnote for you. The Camel fight. You remember that website boxing.com from way back from a few years back, they had an article saying that that might've been the first cruiserweight fight ever.
Yeah. I actually,
well, I mean, that is definitely is the first sanctioned whatever title, but even before a title fight even happened.
Well, it was, that was actually the first website, the first message board I had ever posted on boxing.com back in like 99 or 2000 or something like that. A long time ago anyway. But no, I don't remember that article, but I do remember reading, you know, that take somewhere. I don't remember from where though.
And I think there was a flyer, I think, for that was attached to the article. I did say it right there. That was cool. It had Sharkey and Marvin Campbell, like you mentioned, a future cruiserweight champion. And it said, you know, first cruiserweight fight, blah, 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 blah. And like all in big letters. And
yeah. And well, and we talked about that briefly when we talked about the history of the cruiserweight division, like maybe about a year ago. So, you know, it's out there, but yeah, I don't know. It's something, it's pretty close anyway. It's kind of skinnier yeah. teeth, but
it's interesting because they, you know, with a lot of those guys at that point, they realized that they had no chance at heavyweight. And so they were going to try
exactly.
to move down a little bit. And in that fight, he just got tooled again though.
Yeah, the fighters were starting to get just too big. You know, the guys who were in that kind of like too big for light heavyweight range, you know, 185, 190, 195 kind of range, needed somewhere to go. So it makes sense, but I don't know that it's officially recognized as such or how much, you know, weight the NABF holds. But after losing to Frank Williams, so he takes 3 years off and has a win streak of four fights before losing to Stanley Ross, who I'm not so super familiar with. But then you look and his final fight in 1983 is a first round knockout to Frank Bruno, who was notorious for just pummeling the absolute shit out of opponents early on in his career.
Oh man, Bruno was an absolute monster back then. He was built like it too. That was built like, you know, an Adonis chiseled out of stone. And he could box and he can move. I mean, like, he definitely proved his mettle instead of just being like people think he was like a big stiff or anything, because he proved his worth in the Lennox Lewis fights and other subsequent fights, Tim Witherspoon. But yeah, man, early on in his career, if you watch highlight videos of him, bro, he was brutal.
I hate to say it because he seems like such a nice dude, but he was like the rabbit punching master, dude. That guy, oh my god, like what he did to Jose Ribalta, like he absolutely pummeled the hell out of Ribalta, like the back of Ribalta's head, and he did that shit to a whole bunch of people. So god only knows what he did to Bill Sharkey, but whatever it was.
Well, I think that fight was on YouTube at one point. I'm pretty sure I watched it. Sharkey got absolutely planted badly.
That like, sounds was, about right.
It was bad, man. Bruno, yeah, Bruno. There's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun fights for Bruno back then. If you haven't seen it, check out the one against Jumbo Cummings, for example. Because Bruno he's out on his feet at the beginning, at the end of the first round, he gets caught and he's done. Like he's clearly knocked out. And they just guide him back to the corner and they just wash his leg, they just rev him up. They do everything in their power, and he eventually comes back to stop Cummings, but that first round, if you catch it at the end, bang, bang, boom, Bruno gets hit and he's gone. And then you hear the announcers, oh no, Bruno was finished. He's done. Like he's cooked. Like they all thought he was cooked, and he looked like he was. He was completely cooked. But, you know, Bruno was a fun fighter, man. And like you said, he was a good guy. And he's overcome a lot since his career ended in terms of mental health and other things that he's gone through. So.
Yeah, so I don't want to just trash him, but
man, oh, you definitely not. I mean, rough. His style is his style, bro. You hit people with rabbit punches, you hit them with rabbit punches. You got to call it as you see it, no?
Yeah, it's pretty rough, dude. I don't know what it was about that wide right hand, but
he also had some really. Before I also love that he was like sponsored by one of the first people sponsored by Nike back in the day, because he had a bunch of cool ass gear. If you ever noticed that, like with his trunks and his workout gear and his socks, he used to be like, yeah, man, shit was cool.
Hell yeah, dude. Frank Bruno was, he seems like he would have been a good dude to root for, especially if you're living in the UK. But whatever he did to Bill Sharkey was bad enough that it ended Bill Sharkey's career and made him decide that in 1983, that was it. He retired after that. And so anyway, that basically leads us to where we're going in the icky part. So I'll go ahead and just read from this, just because I don't have it memorized, number one, but also it will help me kind of with my notes. Basically, after this, he retired, and then it wasn't until 1995. So he was born in 1949. So he would have been in his mid-40s, like 45, 46 at this point. In 1995, he re-entered the ring in a tough man competition in Tannersville, Pennsylvania. But he had moved to the Poconos, and he had built a log cabin with a chainsaw. He had moved away from Howard Beach in Queens and moved to the Poconos because he had said that, I love Howard Beach, but I didn't want my son to grow up there. And basically, he, it sounds like he tried to get away from whatever it was that was getting him into trouble in the city. So, I mean, in some way, you know, respectable, like, get the fuck out, bro. You know, I get it, but it sounds like whatever it was, something he could not leave behind, something caught up with it. So what wound up happening, Aris?
Well, on, like you said, I'll just kind of read it myself. On October 24th, 1998, Bill Sharkey's body was found inside the trunk of a burned out car deep in the woods near his house. Apparently placed there, you know, smoked out, smoldering, everything like that. And cops had to figure out, I think, by dental DNA who it was. But once they figured that out, they also figured that he was shot to death beforehand, making this a homicide. And that's why we're profiling him today, huh?
So he was found by a hunter. A hunter had found his body, and the car was engulfed in flames when the hunter came upon it. The place that it was found was called the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area, which is actually federal land. But also, so this is actually not far from the Poconos. The Poconos are like the heart of the Poconos or whatever is northwest of Stroudsburg. And where he was found is just northeast of Stroudsburg. So it actually wasn't really even that far from where he was, but he was shot up, set on fire, and I guess through absolute blind luck, it was, if it was a remote enough area that somebody was hunting, it just happened, I guess.
Like someone just happened to be passing by and saw it.
I mean, I suppose that's kind of like fishy enough as is, and I'd be asking that person a shitload of questions. But even so, I mean, it was a fairly remote area. It was an area that was not, it was like a camping ground that was, you know, not somewhere where a lot of people would be driving through and stuff like that. And it was burned so badly that they had to identify him through dental records, which is some shit that you hear on one of those murder programs you watch, Aris. You know, that's like some shit you hear in movies, you know, like I've never even heard of that being in real life.
That was someone who, whoever was involved, could have been multiple, who knows, but whoever did this job, one, make sure that he wasn't going to be found. Like, this was, you know, they went above and beyond. This wasn't just shooting someone and putting them someplace and whatever. Like, they burned this car completely through, and someone just happened to be passing by when that happened. So,
yeah, bad stuff, dude. For sure.
The question is, though, is that, you know, there's still, that being said, and, you know, it's a crazy scene, there's not a lot of info on what Sharkey might have been up to, because more or less, he went really quiet after his career ended. Like you said, there was a couple of bits and pieces, the tough man, little tidbit there, but not much was really known, you know, around the last decade of his life like that. So to what would have potentially led to this, you know, demise? I've read in a couple of things that they said he might have been involved in drugs, and there was like some evidence that he was like doing something or another around that, but they don't really, you know, nothing really led to anything like that. And obviously the case went cold.
About 10 years later, a local news station had put out a plea about the case, looking for leads, looking for, I don't know, evidence, witnesses, anything like that, any sort of information. So obviously it was unsolved and to the point, and I guess worrisome to the point where they would put out a plea 10 years later after it being unsolved. I mean, that's as good a guess, the stuff that you brought up as far as why it would happen, involved in drugs, old shit coming back to haunt him because he killed somebody back in 1971 and wound up doing some time for it. But we've talked about stuff kind of similar to this, you know, old shit coming back in these other true crime episodes where you just can't, you don't leave that life behind. It doesn't work that way.
Nah, usually everything comes back, you know, full circle at some point or another. And yeah, man, Sharkey had so much going on in his past, like you just mentioned, that it could be a number of different things. Who knows? You know what I mean? It definitely could have been no passing situation where he might have just gotten to an argument with someone, because that's just the nature of this whole of that of how he died and what they did to him is just like really heavy, to the point that like there had to have been a major situation going on with that. There had to have been something big. So whatever he was involved in, that's kind of the mystery of it. But yeah, it's basically there's not much out there after this. You know, like you said, there's been a couple of times the case has been reopened, people are trying to get info on it, and there's been little tidbits here and there, but they don't, no one really has anything.
Yeah, it's not quite I guess I've said this on other true crime episodes, dude. I'm not trying to pretend like I'm an amateur criminologist or anything because I'm not. But, you know, having watched some of those programs or whatever, it seems like overkill would be, for instance, when somebody gets stabbed and you don't just stab them enough to kill them, you stab them 95 times. Like that's overkill. This isn't overkill. This is trying to hide evidence. Like this is trying to, like, you know, you killed somebody and you're lighting their body on fire in the woods. Like that's not the kind of thing where, you know, you're pissed off or something like that and you want it to be found. Like that's you're trying to destroy it. I mean, I will say this though, if it was something old, if it was some old shit that came back to haunt him, you know, over 25 years later, that's somebody with a hell of a fucking grudge. So whatever it was that happened must have been pretty intense or just absolutely the wrong person.
Yeah, man, that's just one thing we don't know at the moment, or we probably will never really know at that. But like you said, dude, if that was something that he did, that is a hell of a grudge to hold for that long to come back on somebody after all those years. But I have no idea. I'm not no detective like this or anything. I can just make guesses like the best of anybody. But considering when he was living in a pretty remote location, like you said, after he moved out of Howard North, Howard Beach, and just wanted to get away from everything and kind of live a quiet life, I guess I'm just gonna assume something must have happened around over there.
That
And
shit's how fucking John Wick movies start, bro. He's like off trying to live a quiet life. I mean, the good thing they killed him because that motherfucker would have been running through a whole like crime house at this point. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. It's obviously, you know, it's pretty wicked, pretty vile.
Here's the thing is that like boxing's such an into and to bring this up again that we've always done in other shows, boxing's such a crazy sport, bro, that this is a story that's never even been like here. Listen to the story we just gave. This is a crazy thing that could be its own documentary. Any of those crime shows that I watch or anyone else is a big fan of or anything like that, this would be something that people would love to see an hour documentary on. People being interviewed and trying to figure out what happened. This is in boxing, no one's even thought, and like 90% of people never even heard of this whole thing because it just gets brushed under the rug because so much shit happens in boxing.
You know what's crazy is, I guess even for that matter, we haven't even brought up the possibility of there being some boxing involvement. Like maybe he fucking double crossed the wrong boxing person. You know what I'm saying?
Oh,
Like, I mean, fuck, bro, boxing's so crazy. It's not impossible.
there's just, you know, a lot of scenarios and variables with this, man.
Yeah, dude.
The one that I could say out of all of them that we've really done, that's the one that's most shrouded in mystery afterwards, in terms of that, like, there's not really an answer. You're not sure if there's going to be an answer. And for over, it's coming up on, what's it been now? Like 24 years or so. And yeah.
In October, yeah, dude, there's, I can't imagine that at this point.
About as lost as they were back then.
Yeah. At this point, it's because the evidence has been burned, you know, the car itself has been burned and they haven't found anything else. It would be so unlikely for them to find something new at this point to solve the crime. So, I mean, I'm not the kind of person that's going to put out any sort of plea or anything like that in that regard, and especially not for me, but I would be interested to know if anything developed from it, or if anybody else has any other information as far as like what they've developed with the case. I'd be curious, but
yeah,
so pretty crazy shit, man.
Well, just another case to add to, you know, that crazy era of heavyweight boxing from the late '70s and early '80s.
Yeah, for sure, dude. Well, hey, I wish that we had a little bit more information, but whether or not we do, I appreciate you taking the time to look this up and talk this out with me, man.
Absolutely, bro. It's always a blast doing this.
For sure. Well, everybody, thank you so much for watching or listening in, whichever method you chose. If you did choose watching on YouTube, if you would subscribe, very much appreciate that. Leave a comment or a review, something like that. If you did listen on a podcast app, same, subscribe, comment, review, etc. Always helpful. But if you're on social media, go ahead and follow us, for instance, on Twitter. My buddy Aris is there at Punch Zone Aris, A-R-I-S. I'm there, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. But we're also on Facebook, Instagram, all those sorts of things. And Aris, we'll talk soon, bro.
Absolutely, man. Have a good one.
For sure. Later, everybody.